The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning service is offered through Jim Solnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us as certified financial planner Jim Solnier, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now, here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
So welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show EDU edition. We're on today's show. We're going to chat a bit about long-term care expenses and how you might approach self-funding those expenses. What kind of considerations are there? And for those of you who think you have enough money to self-fund your long-term care expenses or those potential expenses, what are the things you should think about before determining, yes, that's going to be doable within your plan? And I've got Jim on the, not on the phone. He's in the other room. But we also have a remote guest. Greg's been on once before now, I guess. So now he's a veteran. He's on the show for the second time. And we've got an improved audio setup for Greg. So, Greg, why don't you speak and let everyone hear how clearer your voice is compared to last time.
Well, I hope that's the case. I have some fancy new equipment here. So
yeah, so we'll give it a try. I think it'll be a little more understandable than before. We're dealing with somehow both you and Jim have questionable internet quality. So it's a bit of a challenge, but I think this will be better than last time. Jim, you can hear us okay?
Of course, because I'm Perfect. In the attic right next door to you.
Excellent. So long-term care. I know we've been talking about this a little bit lately, but this is an area a lot of people are interested in. How might we approach determining our ability to fund ourselves long-term care expenses?
Yeah, we have received a lot of feedback from the two shows that we did since my stroke, EDU shows that I've done since the stroke. And I'm just trying to share some information with people on long-term care, or what we in the office called aging assistance, because there's expenses that aren't necessarily covered by traditional long-term care insurance, which, of course, people listening should know. All you do-it-yourself is should know. Long-term care insurance covers you if you can't take care of your life. Whereas as you age, you are going to have expenses when you can't take care of your lifestyle. Long-term care insurance is not going to pay anyone to come and cook for you or drive you around or clean for you. If you're still able to take care of yourself, if you can still function with what they call activities of daily living, but you're just getting older and you can't change light bulbs anymore, you can't do the raking, you can't clean your house because getting up and down repeatedly is tiresome or painful, they're not going to pay for that. So I call that the expenses to take care of your lifestyle, and then there's the expenses to take care of your life. Today we're going to talk about self-funding for the expenses to take care of your life. Lifestyle expenses, you're going to have to build those into your cash flow. You're going to have to build it into your minimum dignity floor if it's important to you, to make sure that the money is there. And you're also going to have to look honestly at where you live, the type of work you're going to need to do to your property. Do you live in a community that offers landscaping as part of living there? I know some communities do, especially condo and townhouse style communities. Or are you on a little bit of acreage by yourself and you have to do everything? So all of that is going to be individualized to you. Today, we're going to be talking about and trying to help our do-it-yourselfers figure out how do you decide if you can afford to self-fund your aging needs for taking care of your life. That's if you can't bathe and you can't dress and you can't transfer, which is a nice way of saying move from the bed to a chair or from the chair to the kitchen and from the kitchen back to the living room. If you can't move, if you can't bathe, if you can't cook and eat and clean yourself and toilet, as they call it. If you can't do those activities of daily living, how are you going to pay for those? Who's going to take care of you? Who's going to provide the service? How is it going to be paid for? And that's what we want to help you understand and figure out. How much of your assets do you really have available to self-fund? So we thought a good way of walking you through these steps, and we want everyone listening, if you're listening to this, I said it 100 times over, you're a do-it-yourselfer. You're probably a Vanguardian with all your money at Vanguard, and we don't say that derogatorily. We believe in passive investing at our firm as well, and we use ETFs, not necessarily funds. But we have nothing against you Vanguardians, so don't worry about that. But one thing that we need to teach you guys, how do you decide if you can afford to self-fund? So we thought we would create a hypothetical person. And this isn't going to apply to every listener, we get that, but take your own set of facts and follow the same logic that Chris, myself, and Greg are going to walk you through. So in our hypothetical situation, we have a couple, a married couple, with $3 million of net worth. And they retired at age 63. To make things easy, we're just going to keep them both the same age. We get into different scenarios if there's an age difference, especially if there's a wide age difference. I don't want to get that deep into the one-offs of this calculation. If you are far apart in age, you're going to have to do a slightly different calculation, obviously. But let's just make them both 63, mm-hmm. About $3 million of net worth, and they're retired. Of their net worth, $500,000 is in their home. Let's just say they own the home free and clear, no debt. They did everything right. They retired with no debt. They have $500,000 home, $2.5 million of liquid retirement assets. We're not going to get into what their tax diversification is, if it's an always taxable, maybe taxable, never taxable. That's immaterial to what we're talking about here today. We're just trying to help you decide and present a question, a rhetorical question almost, because you're going to see by the end of today's show, there's no right or wrong answer here. And the question is, can they afford to self-fund? And you might think, gee, with $3 million net worth, no problem. Well, let's walk through this and decide. So we've created a hypothetical person, a couple rather. We based it off of typical people that we work with, but this is not a real situation. It's a hypothetical. So you've got $2.5 million, Chris, of net worth, of liquid net worth, we call it, money available for retirement expenses. So look at this, folks, the way I'm trying to get our listeners to understand it. You've got a $2.5 million cherry pie. And you want to eat that cherry pie. Because I've told everyone repeatedly on this podcast that $2.5 million is not investments. You may look at it as investments, but the reality is it's deferred spending. That is money that this 63-year-old couple is going to spend. Remember, they are retired. There's no more money coming in. They have $2.5 million of deferred spending that they have to make sure lasts the rest of their lives. What makes this difficult, they don't know how long that will be. It could be one day. It could be 30 more years. They could live to 90s. Both of them could. We don't know how long it's going to last, neither do they. And that's what makes this difficult. So you have to sometimes do some hard calculations and start divvying up that $2.5 million cherry pie and figuring out what slice of pie needs to be saved for what expense. And as you start divvying that cherry pie up, with one of those slices being aging assistance, will there be enough cherry pie left over to have, I guess you could say, immediately for fun things, out of that $3 million, is this couple going to be able to afford to have fun with some money and cover all their other expenses with an unknown end date? I think you would agree, Chris, we said this many times, if the end date was known, this conversation would be a lot easier.
Yeah, that makes retirement planning a heck of a lot more straightforward. It essentially becomes a math problem at that point.
Exactly. So, what would the first calculation, if this was a real couple, what would the first calculation, Chris, be for this couple? What is their first most important consideration that they have to make sure they cover? In other words, the first slice of cherry pie, what does that have to be dedicated to?
Well, under our philosophy, the first thing you have to make sure is covered is the minimum dignity floor. That's the foundation of everything that we preach and do, and that is to make sure that your food, utilities, transportation, housing, and healthcare are handled or addressed with your financial resources for the rest of your life, no matter how long you live. And we break your retirement life up into essentially two main phases when we're addressing the minimum dignity floor. The first phase, we call it the delay period, because in our minds, we want to dedicate first or earmark any secure income that you have towards funding your minimum dignity floor. Before we start diverting some of that over to fund spending, we're going to apply it first to your minimum dignity floor. And for a lot of people, particularly if you're retiring at 63, while it is possible to have turned on your Social Security or maybe a pension if you have one, many people are not turning it on at that point because they are receiving some sort of benefit from delaying the start of their secure income like Social Security and or pension. Or income annuity, if they happen to have that. So during this early phase of retirement, we call it the delay period because there's some funding needed from a resource other than secure income, which essentially means this bucket of this cherry pie, this bucket of liquid assets that are available to cover the minimum dignity floor. And we need to, you know, take our knife out and slice out the piece of that cherry pie that has to be considered already consumed or about to be consumed for the minimum dignity floor. And typical in this kind of scenario with these kind of numbers, I would say that let's assume that during the delay period, so the period until they turn on their Social Security fully, both of them, needs about $400,000 of funding. So in other words, of that $2.5 million cherry pie, $400,000 is needed just to cover the delay period minimum dignity floor. So we'd carve that out first.
Right. And folks, Chris isn't just making that number up. We've seen in our office that a typical need for minimum dignity floor it'd be around $50,000 to $100,000 a year per person, depending on where in the country they live and what their lifestyle is like. So saying for a seven-year period that they're going to need $400,000 to cover their minimum dignity floor, Chris is only factoring in approximately a $60,000 a year need for minimum dignity floor, $60,000 a year for food, utilities, transportation, housing, and health care for two people. Pretty damn close. And it could be a little higher, could be a little lower, but I think that's a very reasonable number that you have there, Chris, for that delay period, the period of time that they're holding off on their Social Security. They don't have any pension, so they need to live off of savings. Remember, the $2.5 million is deferred spending, folks. And get into the mindset, folks. Stop looking at your $2.5 million or your $1 million or your $500,000 or your $5 million, whatever each listener paying attention today has amassed. Stop looking at that as an investment and start looking at it as deferred spending. That's what in the heck you saved it for in the first place. Now start spending it. So that I think, Chris, that $400,000 is very reasonable for the delay period. Now, we're not going to get into what they should be doing with that, how they should invest it and position it, way beyond the scope of today's show. But you can see $2.5 million, but they need about $400,000 for delay period minimum dignity floor. Now their cherry pie is shrunk to $2.1 million. They covered a big portion of their expenses, but now there's only $2.1 million for everything else, including aging assistance. But what's the next calculation they need to figure out, Chris?
Well, the next, I mentioned there's two phases we look at when we're addressing the minimum dignity floor, and that was first the delay period, which we just talked about, what we call the post-delay period. So once all the secure income is turned on, for some people, they will find that their minimum dignity floor might luckily be fully satisfied at that point. That usually only happens if you have two people with both really strong Social Security benefits or a strong Social Security benefit for one, a smaller for the other, and then a small pension thrown in or some combination with some pension income. For those people, they might find their minimum dignity floor in the post-delay period is dealt with. All the projections look like it'll handle their minimum dignity floor. But for quite a few people, they find that they're a bit short, that the Social Security income that I've assumed these folks have covers the vast majority, but doesn't quite get there. And so we say the solution to that is you need to plan or make a plan as a younger couple, as the 63-year-old couple, so that the 70 or 75-year-old couple is in a position financially to generate more secure income. There's a few ways to do that. When I say generate it, the natural occurring ways they would have entered into retirement with would be things like Social Security or a pension. You can't really create those later in life. They are what they are, but you can create other secure income, usually through, you know, one idea is through the use of a simple income annuity. That is a pure form of secure income. It goes every single year. It's very predictable. It's backed by a deep-pocketed third party, and it goes to the very last days you're around. So it's not something that's susceptible to being drawn down too fast or lost like an asset. It's income that's going to come in regular every single year. And so let's say to embellish their current Social Security secure income, they need to reserve, and how we came up with this number is, again, beyond the scope of this talk, but let's say they need another $300,000 at 63 years old. So at the beginning here, when they're divvying up this cherry pie, they need another $300,000 kind of set aside earmarked for the 70, 75, 78-year-old couple to generate more secure income if it turns out they need it, which all the forecasts and projections might show they need it. We tell people to wait until you get there. Just make sure you have the ammunition you need to generate it if it turns out the projections were right and you really do need it. But let's use $300,000 as their need today for the post-delay minimum dignity floor.
So see what he's doing there, folks. And again, the calculation that Chris is using is very reasonable. We often see in our office that immediately upon exiting the delay period and you're entering the post-delay period, which in simple English means all your secure income has been turned on. And in this case, it's just Social Security we were assuming for this couple. So they're both at same age, 63. So at 70, their Social Securities are turned on. And post that need, initially we often find many people cover their minimum dignity floor with just Social Security if their benefits are marginally reasonable or above. But later on in retirement, we call it the crossover point. Inflationary pressures on the minimum dignity floor exceed the cost of living adjustment to Social Security, which is very minimal. And Social Security can't keep pace with the minimum dignity floor expenses of food, utilities, transportation, housing, and health care they're being asked to cover. So there's a shortage. Most of the time, the shortages appear between age 78 and 85. It's all going to vary for people, but somewhere around that, with I think the most typical, Chris, is around 82, 83, somewhere around there. But we're just giving this to you as an example, a real realistic, not real, but a realistic-like example. And then Chris does some calculations. We won't bore you with it, but he just does a calculation to figure out what would an insurance company, I know Chris was using the age, I think, 78, what would an insurance company to a 78-year-old couple want in dollar amounts to fund an income annuity to provide them the expected and projected shortage in their income for the rest of their lives. That's all Chris did there. We're not going to get deep into how he calculated it. And we're also not saying, and he made perfectly clear, and I want to make perfectly clear, we're not saying you're going to buy an income annuity. What we're saying is that's not a decision the 63-year-old couple in our example is going to make. That is a decision the 78-year-old or 80 or 82-year-old, whatever age the shortage actually appears, it's their decision. The responsibility of the 63-year-old, since you can only spend a dollar once, is to say, hey, I got to put this money aside. It's no longer available. This is money that the older me, 78, 80, 83-year-old me, is going to need. I'm putting it aside. And that's all Chris is saying. Our calculation in this hypothetical means they have to put $300,000 aside today. Chris uses a discount rate of 3% on future growth. So you can do a simple calculation, 63 to 78 at 3%. That gives you an idea what Chris calculated they're actually going to need. But what he's doing here initially, and what we're going to encourage you guys to do as you're trying to do this calculation, figure out how much money the older you is going to need. Figure out if there is going to be a crossover point first. And how much money do you have to put aside? What is the growth rate you're going to earn? We, again, assume a safe 3%. We think that's reasonable. And if anything, they'll have far more money than they need, than far less, which is a better predicament to be in. And reserve that money from your cherry pie. So your task now, folks, again, what is your cherry pie? What is the liquid assets? How much are you going to need for minimum dignity floor early in retirement while you're delaying your Social Security and your pension? And how much are you going to need after it's turned on? Is that going to be enough? Are you going to need more? You got to subtract those two. So now in our example, when we take another $300,000 out of this calculation, that brings the $2.5 million of liquid assets down to $1.8 million.
And it's not that that money has disappeared.
No,
nope,
still
don't,
there.
People freak out when the number starts getting lower. It's there. It's just been, what I say, given a job to do. We've now assigned it a task. Jim likes to use this kind of this visual
asset liability
of the pie. You know, the pie being cut out, and we've got these pieces now set off to the side not to be consumed for other purposes. I like to assign it a job, if you will. And this $700,000 we just pulled out of this $2.5 million, its job is to protect the minimum dignity floor for the rest of their lives.
Right. Food, utilities, transportation, housing, and healthcare, a massive amount of their expenses. And to carry on with that cherry pie analogy that we've been using for a while, that slice of cherry pie, the latter one, the $300,000, that went in the freezer, because that's for a long time from now. Mm-hmm. But the other slice of cherry pie Chris took, the $400,000, some of that went on the kitchen table and some of it went in the refrigerator, because it's going to be eaten immediately and over the next couple of years. So you can kind of follow our little analogy of using a cherry pie. But now the $2.5 million cherry pie is down to a $1.8 million cherry pie. Now that $1.8 million is going to be tasked with four different things. You're not out of the woods yet, folks. You're not going to sit there and say, oh, gosh, $1.8 million and I got to cover an LTC event? Oh, no problem. Okay, but let's look at this closely. What are the four remaining elements? Well, you got fund spending. This is the dichotomy of all who are contemplating putting an LTC plan in place. It was one of my issues. I freely admitted on last week's podcast, part of my rationalization of not buying LTC when I could afford it and did not have AFib at the time, or I probably had it, I just wasn't diagnosed with it at the time, was I self-rationalized that I was healthy, and I admitted I'd rather have put the premiums, even though I could afford them, towards an elk hunt or a fishing trip. It was that immediate gratification I wanted. And I rationalized in my mind, I'll wait a little bit longer to buy the LTC. I don't need it right now. Well, with this $1.8 million, that's what you guys got to start looking at. It's going to be a battle between what do I want to spend on fun while I have the health, inclination, and desire still to do it. We all know how this ends. We're not getting younger, stronger, and healthier. When something happens to us and we can't do things on fun anymore, we're going to have memories or regrets. But there's no more middle ground. When you can't travel or fish or hike or hunt or garden like I like to do, or I don't know what everyone else likes to do, I just know what I like to do. When you can't do that anymore, I'm going to have a lifetime of memories or a lifetime of regrets. So I'm going to want to consume as much as I can at first. But common sense says you can only spend a dollar once. And will I need any of that cherry pie in the freezer in case I need LTC? So that's the first thing you're trying to deal with here is fun. Obviously, aging expenses. But also, what about a guaranteed inheritance for those of you where that's important? You may have children who have special needs situations and you have to make sure they have an inheritance. You may have a church that you want to make sure you can tithe a certain percentage of your net worth to them. You might have other family members you want to take care of, other charitable organizations, or like myself, I don't have anyone I need to leave the money to. And a guaranteed inheritance is not important to me. But Chris has a wife, six kids, and probably 14 dogs running around his house right now because they're a horse, not a horse. Dogs. Jeez, yeah. God. Where my head is.
Don't
today.
Give my wife the idea of fostering horses.
Now you're gonna have
that's a whole other level.
So Chris fosters a bunch of horses too. So maybe a guaranteed inheritance is different for him, and the same thing with Greg. So this is another calculation you have to do. And then, of course, folks, a buffer. Do you want to make sure the older you is protected if something you can't even fathom happens 20, 25, 30 years from now? And let's begin with the latter first, Chris. What about a buffer for this person, this couple? They got $1.8 million. What's a reasonable situation we normally see?
Well, this one is very personal, I will say. Has a lot to do with emotions and the idea of this particular buffer. You might think, well, of course we need a buffer to protect, you know, things in the future. Well, remember, this is additional above what we've already set aside for the minimum dignity floor protection and if you put an aging plan in place, all those kinds of things. So this is kind of in addition. And I find it most useful for people who still have trouble spending their own money even after they get all the jobs assigned. They find that their final fund number, they still can't spend it because they're too worried. A buffer is really helpful in that particular instance. But a lot of people use a kind of a percentage approach to this, where they'll say, okay, you know, we've kind of dealt with this. We've got these liquid assets, which we know are the main bucket of all the spending in retirement. Let's add a cushion of, say, 10% or something, and just consider that an extra level of or layer of protection or reserve buffer. So in that particular case, if they started with $2.5 million, it would be pretty common for people to identify $250,000 as a reasonable stuff it in the mattress just in case, makes me feel better knowing it's there in case something out of the blue shows up.
Okay, so now they're going to take, they had $1.8 million, mm-hmm. Isn't that what we had as the last one? Mm-hmm. And now they're going to put an additional $250,000 aside, leaving them about $1.55 million. Do you follow that, folks, so far what we did there? So we started with the 2.5, we put the reserves for the minimum dignity floor, and now a buffer. The buffer is really to give peace of mind. I have said on this podcast before, and I will say it again, the day you retire, it is going to freak you out. There is no more salary coming in. There is no more savings. All you Vanguardians, the biggest weakness, Greg is going to share with us some of the weaknesses of self-funding. But one of the biggest weaknesses of self-managing your assets, granted, you're not doing the AUM, the uncapped AUM strategy, hiring an advisor who is going to charge you 1% of assets. I know you're saving a lot of money there. That's great. We love that. But one of the biggest weaknesses of managing your own money is you've developed an emotional attachment to your portfolio. It's your baby. You've nurtured it. You've grown it. You've pruned it, pruning by rebalancing. You've allocated it. It's yours. I sometimes feel that way when I have to go out and harvest some vegetables from my crops. I'm like, oh, God, I don't want to pilk that. It's going to hurt the plant. I spent all summer growing it. Well, you develop a much deeper attachment to your portfolio when you don't want to spend it. And the minute something bad is happening and your portfolio is dropping because of Wall Street is taking it, it's going to freak you out. And you're going to self-rationalize these reasons not to spend it. Well, one of the ways of overcoming that is knowing, well, I've got this buffer. So buffer helps from an emotional standpoint too. And I think 10% of liquid net worth, we see that all the time. Some people save less, some people substantially more. I think Chris is being very reasonable at 10%. In other words, we're not juicing this at all. We're trying to show you a very realistic approach that people will take with dollars that are very reasonable for a lot of people paying attention to this podcast today. So out of the 2.5 million, they're down to 1.55 million, or about $1 million is already spoken for other expenses. But before we get to aging expenses, there's one more option you got to cover, because we still have aging and fun. But before we get to aging, we're going to look at a guaranteed inheritance. This one we have literally seen clients argue amongst each other in the case of couples if this is important or not. We have literally seen that.
We can't help you with the argument. You have to come to the conclusion yourselves.
There's one spouse who absolutely positively wants to guarantee that there's an inheritance, usually to children, but it could again be to a church or a charity or to another human or to something. One spouse wants to absolutely guarantee it, and the other spouse could care less. If there's anything left, they can have it, because what are they doing there? Especially the spouse who doesn't want to guarantee the inheritance. They're self-rationalizing. There's nothing wrong with it, but they want that immediate gratification. They're sitting there saying, I entered retirement with $3 million of net worth. $500,000 of it is tied up into my home, and I can't access it yet unless I do a reverse mortgage or unless I take out a home equity loan. It's kind of tied up. I got $2.5 million. I'm already down to $1.5 million. And he or she wants to take more now and give it to people who probably aren't even going to need it or maybe not even appreciate it. And they start getting into that. So it's a very emotional decision. We're going to leave it to you guys to decide. But if you want a guaranteed inheritance, if it's very important, I can't say this enough. You can only spend a dollar once. Now, granted, much of the dollars that we're reserving for minimum dignity floor and for buffer may never get spent. Now, you could self-rationalize and say, okay, they can have the buffer and the minimum dignity floor that I'm not going to spend as their guaranteed inheritance. But is that guaranteed, Chris?
No.
No, because you can only spend a dollar once. And what if you do need the buffer? Or what if you do? Well, you probably will need the minimum dignity floor if you live to mortality, which we have at 93 in our analysis. But you probably will spend that. That's what our analysis determines. But you can't rely on that money being there. Oh, I'm going to reserve it in case I need it, but it's also going to be my guaranteed inheritance. It can't be both. So sometimes you have to take more money and reserve it. I won't get deep into guaranteed inheritance strategies and leveraging using second-to-die guaranteed universal life policies or CRT trusts or things like that. We won't get into that. But let's just assume, Chris, a reasonable million and a half, so we can round the number, I think is a reasonable, not a million and a half.
150,000 would round
million
it down.
And a half, they wouldn't have anything left.
Right.
They got 50,000 left for long-term care.
Yeah, no more pie at that point.
So let's just assume 150,000, folks, to placate this. We could have went, they don't want to give any guaranteed inheritance, or they want to guarantee each of their three children 200,000 each, and we're pulling 600,000 out of this. So this, we just want you to understand the logic here. You started with a $3 million net worth, but $500,000 is tied into real estate, your home. So you got $2.5 million of liquid net worth. Now, granted, as Greg will talk about and Chris will talk about, part of the $500,000 in that home could be used for aging assistance, as you'll see. But right now, we're looking at the $2.5 million of liquid net worth. We reduced it down for the delay and post-delay period of your minimum dignity floor. We reduced it down for your buffer. Now we're reducing it down for a guaranteed inheritance, but a small one, just to show you guys that this calculation needs to be done. But you subtract out the $150,000 from the $1.55 million. What do we have now, Chris?
Now we're at $1.4
million. Okay, so we have about $1.4 million. Still a good chunk of change, but less than half of their net worth. And we have two more calculations to do. And here is where the argument between the younger you and the older you comes into play. Because that last bit of $1.4 million in cherry pie needs to be divvied between the younger you and the older you. The older you is deathly afraid of being stuck in a nursing home alone by themselves or unable to pay for it. Or they want to stay in a nice nursing home that doesn't take Medicaid patients. Or they want to stay in an assisted living home. They want to be as independent as possible. So they want to try to stay in their home for as long as they can. And they're worried and they want the money. So they're screaming in your left ear, hey, that $1.4 million, you got to put a lot aside for us. We might need it. And then there's the younger you screaming into your right ear saying, whoa, wait a minute. They may not even live long enough. They may not even be sick and need it. We want to go have fun with that. Your fun spending is going to decline as you age. You got to enjoy what those two guys on the podcast call your go-go phase of fun spending before you enter the slow-go and no-go phase. We need that $1.4 million for us. We want to go have fun for at least the next 6, 7, 10-year period, perhaps, if we can still do it. We want to have fun. This is it. It's not a dress rehearsal for the real thing. When we're gone, we're gone. And you're already in your 60s. So you see this argument forming, folks. You only got $1.7 million. Who gets what? And what is enough to make all this work? So the next step you have to do, if you're entering this phase, the next step is, well, wait a minute. You could figure out what you want to spend on fun, or you could figure out what you want to spend on long-term care and aging assistance. Let's do the latter. So now we have to say, okay, well, let's just see if this $1.4 million is enough to cover an aging assistance for us. And that brings us into the calculations that we talk about and have spoken about on this podcast before. What is long-term care expenses? What are you realistically likely to experience? And we've talked on previous shows, so I won't get into it on this one. But basically speaking, there's two types of strategies. Are you looking to protect yourself from a typical long-term care event or an atypical event? A typical event is exactly what it sounds like. Most people who need long-term care need it for less than 3 years. It's not a long time. Generally happens in the later stages of our lives when our bodies are already worn out, and now you can't take care of yourself for one reason or another, and you might live another 5 months, you might live another month, you might live another year, year and a half. A few people might make it close to the full 3 years. But most people who need long-term care need it for less than 3 years. That's why we call it a typical expense. But there's also the atypical, and about 20% of people will fall into that category. The whole reason we're doing this show is because yours truly has just been thrust into that category. And I won't bore everyone with what my issues are. Everyone knows it because I'm being open and honest with all of you. So I'm faced with a more than 3-year long-term care need. For me, it was because of a stroke, but it could be caused by Alzheimer's, dementia, Parkinson's. There's any number of wonderful diseases and conditions out there that can befall about 20% of people who live past the age of 65. I didn't even get to 65 when it happened to me. But about 20% of us might need in 20% of people who need long-term care, which is about 78% of everyone past the age of 65. But 80% of those people need it for less than 3 years, but 20% of those people need it for more. Is that important? Does that apply in your situation? Be honest with yourselves. If your mom and dad both had Alzheimer's or strokes or Parkinson's or dementia, or you are sitting there with AFib like I am, or any other condition that people may have that may prevent you from being able to take care of yourself, you might need more than 3 years. If you're healthy and fit and reasonable and you want to protect yourself for 3 years, I think that's fair. But you need to make sure you have an honest discussion with yourself of if you need a typical or atypical level of care. Now, in our office, Greg is the one who does this, and he chats with clients about this. And Greg, why don't you share with our listeners perhaps a little bit of how clients react when you bring that part up to them? Do they really look at it deeply, you feel, or do they just say, oh, let's do the less than 3 years? Or what do you see? What's your insight when you're trying to decide between a typical and atypical need?
Well, I commonly see clients who have a family history, in particular of chronic disease such as Alzheimer's or Parkinson's. I find that they are more attuned to that risk and might be more likely to want us to evaluate covering a longer term event like that. So I think more often it's the typical event people are concerned with. But again, in the case of the atypical, a lot of it seems to emanate from family history or experience they've had with caring for their parents who had that type of chronic disease.
Okay. And Chris, anything you want to add with what you've seen?
No, I think people struggle with this, trying to figure out how they want to go. It's one of those where you're not going to know what you need. So you have to be honest with yourself that if you pick, I only want to protect against the typical 3 year or less need, you are, if you've gone through most of your other resources, you are exposing yourself to starting to eat into some of the other parts of the pie, or maybe there's no pie left and you then fall into the Medicaid category or on the goodwill of other family members or something like that. So it's just because you've decided in your mind that you only want to protect against a 3 year need, there's always the potential that something longer than that's going to happen. So just make sure you're okay or comfortable with that possibility. You're a bit of playing the odds, if you will. If it were me, I would look at it as, well, how bad would it really be? If that happened, how terrible would my situation be? And if it's palatable, if it's a situation, because it's highly unlikely, right? We're talking about 20% of 78%, which my math, 15.6% is what that ends up being. So the vast majority of people aren't going to be in that position. So you are playing the odds by kind of ignoring it, if you will, or putting it aside, not directly addressed is probably the better way of saying it rather than ignoring it. You've addressed that it's there, but you've consciously made the decision to leave that exposure. Because if you were, especially if you're going to self-fund, if you're trying to self-fund for 7 or 8 years, your fund budget's gone, essentially.
Exactly. And
unless you have just overwhelming resources. And Greg can share with us what this kind of institutionalized need costs people.
And that's exactly what I'm trying to get people to see here is we're down to $1.4 million, which is still a good amount of money. But as Yogi Berra said, a nickel won't buy you a dime anymore, or a nickel ain't worth a dime anymore. $1 million isn't like it used to be on Gilligan's. If Gilligan's Island came out today, it would have to be the billionaire and his wife, because the millionaire and his wife, who cares? But in the 60s, the millionaire was the one. $1 million... As Yogi Berra said, a nickel won't buy a dime anymore. So, or is it a dime ain't worth a nickel anymore? What did Yogi say? I think a dime isn't worth a nickel, or a nickel won't... figure out what it is, because I'm probably muffing it up Well, you're always Googling, so
we'll let you off the hook on this one.
Well, I'm curious.
We'll give you the stroke pass.
Well, last time you had to solve some stupid question for everyone that nobody cared about. So, anyways, as Greg is helping me here, you figure out what Yogi Bear said about nickels and dimes.
A nickel ain't worth a dime.
Okay, so anymore. I was right. Nickel ain't worth a dime anymore. But 1,000,004 in our example, and we still have to fund fun. What if this couple, what if you listeners truly do? Don't try to rationalize like I did and come up with excuses. I got an email that I'm going to share on the podcast from an MD who told me, and I'll share his email, but he said to me in his email, you were not healthy. You were fit. And you misidentified being fit with healthy. Stop saying you were healthy. I loved when he pointed that out to me because I used to always say I was healthy. I'm not overweight. I'm at an equal weight. I have no diabetes. I have everything fine with me. I just have this little condition called AFib. No, I was not healthy. Be honest with yourself. Are you truly as healthy as you think? Is there a familial history of one of these conditions? It can happen to anyone at all. I had a stroke, my ex-brother-in-law got Parkinson's, and my Uncle Benny has dementia. And that's in my little world alone. This can happen to anyone. And when you're self-funding, you're not going to get insurance when something bad happens. I can tell you that. And if you're self-funding for a three-year need, a typical need, but what befalls you is an atypical need, and I'm not saying an extra year or two, this couple has enough assets to probably scrape together that. But what about dementia? My Uncle Benny is my dad's age, 86 or 7, I forget. He's had Alzheimer's for over a decade. I don't know how much longer he's going to live because life expectancy isn't much past that. But financially, it was a drain on his side of the family. And again, he's not my real uncle. He's my father's first cousin. We always called Benny Uncle Benny. But I'm just sharing with you that. Be honest with yourself because you spend this $1.4 million on fun. And then all of a sudden you need it for LTC and you're trying to sell fun because you don't want to buy any insurance. You might not have enough. Anything you want to add, Greg?
I don't think so right now, Jim. I think other than maybe to reiterate or emphasize that I counsel clients to think more about the potential impact of needing this type of care rather than what their risk or their perceived risk is. So,
so what is the kind of average maybe? I'm sure people are wondering, well, what is the dollar amount? How much is it going to cost me for this atypical or typical need? What's the yearly cost for institutionalized care, Greg?
So the latest numbers in terms of the national median is for nursing home or skilled nursing facilities. Private room in that type of facility is about $106,000 a year. Now, keep in mind that there are ranges across the country, so it really varies significantly depending on where in the country you live. So, for example, for that type of care, it ranges from $69,000 per year all the way to $172,000. Alaska's is $437,000 a year is the median. So that gives you an idea of the cost. If you look at in-home care, it's about half that. So the median for in-home care is about $55,000 per year. Mm-hmm. So that's the key thing that we look at when we're working with clients is where do you live? Where do you plan to live in retirement? And let's drill down and look at the historical data on cost and come up with a reasonable projection for the future cost.
And do keep in mind, folks, a couple of things that Greg just said. You can't say, oh, well, I'm going to do the in-home care. It's about half. That's wonderful, and everybody wants to stay in the home. But if something happens to you and you actually need to be put into a facility, you need that constant care, then you have no choice. You can't get full nursing home care in your own home. So keep that part in mind. But also keep in mind, and Chris, when we started talking about this after my stroke, I thought you worded this quite well, so I want you to run with this, and hopefully you'll remember what you worded quite well when I throw you under the bus in a second. It's different for single and married folks, and you have to calculate that in. In our hypothetical example, we're talking about a married couple. But if one of these spouses predeceases the other, it instantly becomes easier for the surviving spouse. Now, I knew this because I'm a single man. And I knew after my stroke, I wasn't going to get long-term care anymore. And I had to refigure how I was going to fund my LTC. And I shared with people that I moved the building that I hold, my office, from the fund part of my cherry pie ledger to the aging assistance part of my cherry pie ledger, which greatly reduced my amount of fund spending I'm going to do in retirement, but gave me a lot of the equity that I will need to help protect myself, or the assets that I'm going to need to help protect myself because I can't. Essentially, the building became the LTC policy that I always was going to buy, but I had to take that money from the fund side. But one thing you explained, Chris, and explained to our listeners, is that a single person has higher expenses at first, whereas a married person has higher expenses later. What did you mean by that?
Well, it's kind of a reverse timeline, if you will. When there's two of you around in the same household, when there starts to be the early stages of the degradation of your physical abilities, your spouse is there to help you. So you can stay in your home for a bit longer because there's someone there naturally that can pick up the slack, if you will, around the home for things that maybe you can't physically do. So those costs might be lower at first as you enter this path towards long-term care ultimately and needing professional care in an institution fashion. So then later on, it becomes very expensive, though, because if that spouse that was on this path ends up in an institution, you now have to fund the institutionalized care for that person and still maintain the home for what we call the community spouse who's out there. Very expensive. So you save some money up front by providing your own in-home care for a while, but that had big dollar amounts on the back end. A single person has it the opposite. A single person on the front end doesn't have anybody in the household. They're single. As soon as they need in-home care of any kind, even if it's minor, they have to pay for it professionally for people to come in. That's assuming if you don't have family around. Hopefully you might get that benefit, but you can't always assume that's going to be there. And sometimes even if it's there, you don't want to be that burden on your kids or other family members. So if you're not going to be that burden, you're going to have to pay for people to come in and help you with your landscaping and doing a little cooking and heavy lifting and all these things that could your other spouse might have been able to help you with if you had a spouse. So immediately you have more expenses up front. But in the long run, there's less expenses because once you leave the home to go to the institution, you don't have to support both. Only one has to be supported. The community home can be sold. And all the expenses that were sucking up some of your income and resources are now gone. You're not supporting that house. All those resources can now be directed toward the institution. So it's kind of the opposite problem. And if you're single already, you only are facing one of these issues. If you're a couple, you're going to face kind of some combination of both. Hopefully only one of you has this issue, if either one. Hopefully neither has this issue. I should say it that way. If one has it, hopefully not the second one, but in the case where it's one and then the other, the first one that needs the institutionalized care is going to be very expensive because you're supporting both. Once that first of you passes, it actually becomes a bit less of an overall burden because of what I shared about the community home not needing to be supported anymore if an institution's in the story. So that's really what I meant by that, and to consider that and think about that and how you have to customize your approach to this depending on where you fit in this couple versus single kind of a scenario.
Good. That's what I wanted you to say, so you did remember that.
Yeah.
And that's where the home equity ties in. Remember, this couple has $500,000 in home equity. If in the couple phase, one spouse needs help, and when you're self-funding, Chris, before you start vegging again, you hit the nail on the head last week on this too as well. When you self-fund, do you self-fund assuming the best or the worst?
Well, if you want to do it properly, you have to assume the worst, because even if you factor in, Jim mentioned, think of family history and assess your risks and all that kind of stuff, that works best when you're risk pooling like an insurance company is doing. They can get a very good handle on their true financial exposure by assessing the risk in the pool. You don't have a pool of one person, you know, or a couple. You have a pool of one entity. And so that one entity might be on either extreme, even though our best guess is based on family history, you're not likely to have a long-term event. You definitely could. And you either have to choose to ignore that or not address it directly, or if you want protections, you've got to plan for that. You have to assume that that worst case scenario is going to happen when you set aside or position resources to handle that. You can't just manage your whole situation for the likely outcome. You kind of have to err on the worst case scenario outcome as far as your protection level.
Right. So you have to assume the worst. So the worst for a married couple is just one of you need help me out here, guys. My stroke must be bothering me.
The atypical event, the
Thank
long-term
you.
Event.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So you've got this worst-case scenario that one of you needs to go into a facility. And Greg has already said the median national average is $106,000 a year. Let's just say $100,000 a year. Now, all of a sudden, the worst-case scenario for the married couple, something happens. Could be a stroke like happened to me. But unlike me, who for some reason God blessed and let the doctor save me, what if I was totally unable to communicate and totally paralyzed on the left-hand side, like I was momentarily during my stroke? Now I'm in a facility. And if I had a wife at home, she has to take care of the home and cover the expense. But if I was single, as I am, and that happened to me, I know I'm out of the house. I'm going to sell the house, or my agent is going to sell it because I'm not going to be in a position to sell the house, and direct all that money towards my care. So you can get a little idea of the difficulty in deciding how much do you reserve. As a couple, how much does this couple in our example reserve? Well, we don't know. Is the first spouse to need it going to be during the couple situation? Or is the first spouse who needs it in a widow-widower situation when they're essentially like me, single, and if they need a worst-case scenario, they're going to sell the house, they're going to go into a facility, all their secure income, all the expenses tied to the house is gone, all their income, all their assets, all their equity can go to their care, and it's a little easier to afford. But this is the conundrum you guys as a couple have to face in this part of the calculation. When is the spouse who's going to need it? As a couple or as a widow-widower? If it's a couple, you now have to cover all the expenses of the house plus the worst case scenario, the expenses being that the spouse who needs it is not in the home where it's quote unquote only going to cost $50,000 a year, but they're in a facility where it's going to cost $100,000 a year. And if you're in a high cost state, it could be double or triple that. And if you're in a low cost state, it'll be a little less than that. This is the conundrum, and it's not easy to figure out. But you got $1.4 million of cherry pie you got to divvy up. And how much are you going to divvy? And how much do you put aside? And the more money, what if you're worried about an atypical event and you want to cover 6 or 7 years? And at $100,000 a year, you could be faced with having to put away $600,000, $700,000, $800,000. You only got $1.4 million. And is that for each of you or for one of you? And the more money you put aside for long-term care, the less money you're going to have for fun. And the younger you want to spend on fun. And this is the conundrum
everybody has. And this is the conundrum you are going to have. And there's no answer. We're not going to magically tell you something on this podcast that's going to solve it. You have to solve this working with your advisor, or if you're do-it-yourself, working amongst yourself, trying to figure out what is reasonable. What makes the most sense for you? But you can't go like that doctor told me in an email just last week. I was not healthy. I misconstrued being fit with being healthy. I was not healthy. That doctor was 100% correct. So you've got to be honest with yourself as well. And just because you might sit there and say, well, not only am I fit, I'm healthy. I don't have any of those things Jim says. Doesn't mean something bad isn't going to happen to you. So that $1.4 million still needs to be divvied up. Now, let's just say, guys, that this couple wants to protect, just so we can walk our listeners through this as we wrap up, a typical event. They don't want to go on the atypical, 3 years or more. So they're not looking for 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 years. They're saying, how about a typical event? Let's do that example first. If it's each typical event is 3 years, that's 6 years total that they have to protect. Because it's 3 years or less is the typical event. They can't assume, as Chris already pointed out, you can't say, well, I'm only going to need it for a year. I'm not going to be the one who needs it for 3 years. That's being in denial. Just admit to yourself, I'd rather spend that money on fun. I don't want to reserve as much for long-term care. But if you are going to preserve for a typical event, it's about $100,000 a year. And the worst case scenario is you need the care from day one. Now, we fully acknowledge most people will start with care in the house, then go into assisted living, and only for about the last 7 or less months of their life are they in a nursing home where the full cost is. But you can't assume that's going to be you. Right. So the worst case scenario is they need $300,000 each or $600,000. Now, they could say, look, we'll put $300,000 aside for one of us, and we're only going to put half the amount aside for the other spouse because we're going to assume the first spouse dies before the other spouse and then that spouse can use the equity in their home. We've seen that rationalization before and you can do that and I think it's reasonable. But we've also seen people who said, no, I'm going to put $300,000 aside for me and $300,000 aside for my spouse. And we'll use the equity in the home to help the surviving spouse if need be. Or if the first spouse who needs it for more than 3 years, they're going to take from the community spouse, that's what the industry calls the healthy spouse, we're going to take from their $300,000, almost like a shared pool benefit in the long-term care vernacular. In other words, the spouse that's still living in the house is saying, hey, wait a minute, the $300,000 I had aside for my spouse in the nursing home is gone. I need more. I'm going to use mine. And then that spouse can say, and if it's gone, I'll use the equity in the home for myself or something like that. Yep. So these are all things that you can factor. So let's just assume, Chris, this couple wants to put $600,000 aside, $300,000 each. Now, if we did that, they're down to $800,000, folks. And that's what their quote-unquote fun number is. And that's what they can spend on having fun. Is that enough for them? It depends. They're only 63. Will their go-go phase be 10 years? That takes them to 73. How much do they want to spend of that $800,000 on go-go fun? I mean, that I don't know. Everyone is different. And that's where clients have to start looking at that themselves and saying, is this enough? If that's enough, if the $800,000 for go-go, slow-go, no-go fun spending is enough for what you want to do, then you just divvied up your entire cherry pie. Mm-hmm.
And you have the potential to be in this category of self-funders.
Absolutely. But if that $800,000 isn't enough, you had hoped for more, you entered retirement with $300,000 and you thought you were going to buy a vacation home, you were going to get a new car, you were going to maybe rent or purchase a camper, you were going to go do all this stuff, and you start to think, wait a minute, $800,000 isn't enough for us to get the lakeside home, and we were going to go spend our winters in Florida. We wanted to do, and well, wait a minute, there's not enough. Everyone is different. Everyone is different, but at least starts to tell you if you could, quote unquote, self-fund. But recognize there's two huge risks here. Greg is going to share some risks that he wants you to know about when self-funding. And I'm going to share with you one thing before Greg goes into this. The other risk in this scenario is one or both of these people need an atypical event. But could you imagine if they wanted to protect for an atypical event? We worry we're going to need LTC for more than 3 years. What if we are your Uncle Benny with a 10-year need? That's $1 million. Now, granted, you don't have to put $1 million away right at front. You might be able to let it grow a little. I get all that time value of money calculations. But what if one of them needed $1 million and the other one needed a few hundred thousand for them? They only got $1.4 million.
Right. Now the fund is zero.
Or getting damn close to it. So follow our logic on a strategy that Greg and I will share with you in greater detail on another show. But what if that $600,000 they put aside, what if it wasn't even $600,000 that they put aside? What if they put aside just $400,000. They took $200,000 that they wanted to, remember, they want to cover a 3-year need, but they got to put $600,000 aside, and it might lower their fund spending too much. Or what if they wanted to put $600,000 aside, but they wanted to cover a long-term care event, an atypical event? Let's look at both of those. So what if they put $400,000 aside? What could they do with that? They took the other two to put it to the fund to give them $1 million for fund, not $800,000. But now they only have $400,000, and they're trying to protect a 3-year full-blown event for both of them. How can they do that with just $400,000? Well, you might say, well, easy. They got to earn a lot more on it. They should invest it aggressively. And yeah, you can do that, but there's no guarantee on any of that. But what if they did this, folks? They put the $400,000 aside, and every year, so they got $400,000 aside, and every year they took 3% of that $400,000, just 3%, which is $12,000. They took 3% of the earnings from that account and directed it into traditional long-term care policies. They're self-funding. So all you do-it-yourselfers, they're still self-funding. So don't freak out. The question becomes, when you self-fund, what is the wisest use of all the interest and dividends and capital gain that you are going to reinvest into that self-funded portfolio? Is it wise to put all of the capital gains, interest, and dividends back into the investment? Or should you take not 3% of the capital gains, earnings, and interest, 3 percentage points? So if you earn 6% of interest, dividends, and cap gains, you're taking half of the earnings. So it's 3 percentage points of the interest, dividends, and capital gains every year of that investment, and pull it out and keep the rest in. So 1 year, you still might be investing 3, 4, 5, 6 percentage points. Another year, you might not be investing anything. And if it's a negative year, you might be increasing your negative by an additional 3%. I get all that. But what if you're just taking 3 percentage points a year of interest, dividends, and capital gains from that portfolio and put that $12,000 into traditional long-term care insurance? Could you leverage 12,000 a year as a grow 12,000 a year into the future, which could be from the very next day? You don't know when you're going to have the condition. Into what you can get from an LTC policy? No way. Absolutely no way. Greg, if you had a 63-year-old married couple living in Centerville, USA, they're not in an expensive state, they're not in a cheap state, they're right in the middle. They want to buy a traditional LTC policy. They're going to fund it with $12,000 a year of premium. Without getting too deep into it, because I'm going to have you get a lot more deep into it when we go into the strategy in greater detail, about how much of a benefit would they be able to purchase by time they're 83 and might need it? What do you think that $12,000 a year into a traditional LTC policy with a cost of living adjustment and a pool of benefits, how much of benefit do you think that would be worth in 20 years? Either by dollar amount or by years. Would that buy an additional 3, 4, 5, 6 years?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to throw numbers out, Jim, without more information, but my estimation with that kind of earnings going toward an insurance policy, you're easily going to fully cover any in-home care or assisted living and probably most of the cost of nursing home care, probably at least 3 to 5 years. I mean, it really depends on the policy. And
we'll get exact numbers for you folks, but follow the logic of what I'm saying, folks. You put $400,000 aside instead of $600,000. That $400,000 is still going to buy 3 years for someone. But by leveraging this, and this would be 5 years for each spouse, correct, Greg?
Yes.
So now by leveraging that $12,000, rather than reinvesting 3 percentage points of interest, dividends, and cap gains, you take 3 percentage points of your interest, dividends, and cap gains and plow it into an LTC policy. You just gave the husband and wife 5 additional years of coverage. Plus, you still have the 3-year pool, actually a little bit more than 3 years, probably 4 years, but you still have the original pool of money. You see how leverage works, folks. When you self-funders say, I'm not buying insurance because it stinks, it's this, it's that, it's the other thing. When I was laying on the floor of my bond, paralyzed because of my stroke, I knew I had health insurance, and I felt very happy over that. And did I tell everybody on this part? I don't know. The latest I looked, folks, the cost of my stroke was $250,544, and I haven't looked to see what it is. That was in December. That's how much. No, $244,519. That's how much this stroke had cost me up to that, but not me, cost the insurance company up to that point. That's the power of leverage of insurance. So what I'm trying to get you to understand, sometimes when you self-fund, you could put $600,000 aside and protect each spouse for 3 years. How about put $400,000 aside, put $200,000 more towards fun, and protect each spouse for 5 years with insurance, an additional 3-year pool that they're kind of sharing from their self-funded money? That's the power of leverage on self-funding. You can still invest some, and the question becomes, what do I do? I'm self-funding, and I have nothing against you do-it-yourself or self-funding. What I'm trying to get you to understand is, what's the wisest thing to do with your interest, dividends, and cap gains? Reinvest it all, or pull 3 percentage points, not 3%, 3 percentage points of your interest, dividends, and cap gains a year out? Now, granted, if you earn nothing, you're going to have to go into principal and pull 3% out, or maybe more if your portfolio dropped. I get all that. But eventually, that money is going to grow. You know it, and I know it. And it will easily be able to support the withdrawal. And if you pulled 4 percentage points or 5 percentage points, you can get even a richer policy. If you pull 1 or 2, you'll get a weaker policy. The question becomes, when you self-fund, what do you do with the interest, dividends, and capital gains? That's the question. What do you do with it? Reinvest it or leverage it? That's the other thing I want you guys to think about as you try figuring this out. But it's a wonderful way to reserve enough money to cover a typical event, but give you one heck of a good backstop for an atypical event. And Greg, if you are self-funding, I know you really wanted to share with our listeners some items that you feel are concerns that a lot of self-funders don't think of. What are those items you want our listeners to know? Hopefully they have enough info to start doing some calculations with some Excel spreadsheets or some pen and paper, a pencil and paper, and a calculator. But when they are deciding if they should self-fund, what are the other elements you wanted to share with them?
So there are a number of things to think about if you're taking the self-funding approach. If you need care, you might be forced to draw from your assets when the market's down, for example. That's, first of all, going to potentially have unlikely have undesirable tax consequences when you withdraw from your assets to pay for care. But it's also potentially going to compromise your other financial commitments that you've made in your retirement plan. The other thing to consider, and Jim, you talk a lot about our lack of or reduced understanding of our ability to handle financial concepts as we get into our 80s. And if you think about this scenario where now you have to rely on drawing from your assets, you're in your 80s, are you going to know which accounts to draw from? Are you, particularly in a widow-widower scenario, are you going to have somebody to help you figure that out? So the financial caretaking aspect of it is very important, particularly when you're self-funding. There are a couple of other things to mention. When you have long-term care insurance, one of the benefits that comes with most policies to varying degrees is care coordination. So help with figuring out, developing your plan of care, figuring out what kinds of services you need, helping you with filing claims, ongoing case management. So those are typically provided in policies. If you're self-funding, you have to rely on yourselves. If you have a partner or a spouse or your family, or hire a professional to help you navigate the care landscape, if you will. And I think one more thing to mention too is you can set that money aside with the intention that it's untouchable, it's reserved for care. You're going to use the earnings and reinvest them and let that grow. But there's potential. You know, there's no guarantee that that money will be there in full. There's no guarantee on the return on that money. So these are things to consider. And I think, Jim, you mentioned the leverage already. When you're self-funding, it's dollar for dollar. You're not really getting any leverage for your money.
Okay, I think the most important that you shared there, the tax situation, I do want to point out, it might not be as bad as that because you may be able to get some good tax deductions under the recently passed bill for coronavirus relief. I don't know if this is bill, what, 3 or 4 that they've passed. They have made, quote-unquote, permanent, which means it's permanent until the next Congress changes it, the 7.5% deduction for medical expenses. So you might have some medical expenses that could help with the tax situation, but you are correct, Greg. There can be some negative tax implications, absolutely, especially if the majority of our clients' money or listeners' money, in this case, is in an always taxable account. Then you are going to be hit with taxes coming out of an IRA on your self-funding, whereas LTC proceeds are tax-free. So then you would have to deduct anything in excess of 7.5% of your adjusted gross income. You'd be able to deduct, but anything below that, you're still going to be paying taxes on. So taxes are a big thing, especially if you have most of your money in an always taxable account. I do want to point that out. But I think the most important part that you fixated on is the insurance companies, many of them, Pac Life and Mutual Omaha are two that come to mind, but Greg knows of others. They do have what the industry calls concierge service with LTC policies. Older policies didn't have this, and filing claims were nightmares. And the person who needs it is either mentally incapacitated or totally physically incapacitated, and they're not thinking straight anyways, and they're in no position to fill in the paperwork. And family, friends, children are trying to file claims and file paperwork, and they don't understand the policy. They don't know what's going on. There's no one there to help them. A lot of insurance companies have concierge service. Pac Life is known as having one of the preeminent ones, but as I said, Mutual of Omaha and a few others have them. In the case of Pac Life, they actually have outsourced to an independent company, an independent third-party company that assists their claims or the claimants to filling in the paperwork or assisting the family. They actually send a nurse to your home to assess your home situation, what needs to be done to the home to make it friendly for the person who now needs the care if they're trying to do in-home care. How are they going to coordinate other benefits they're entitled to and filing and getting into the nursing home as well as filing the claims with Pac Life? You get a lot of help in these concierge services. So there's some benefits there to that. And if you are self-funding, you have to recognize you might not get that help. Now, there are companies you can hire that will ostensibly help with all of that. But how well do they know it? I don't know. I know the company that Pac Life uses knows their policy inside and out. So you don't have to sit there trying to hope the person can figure out what the policy covers, what it doesn't cover. They know it. And they know everything about it. So you can get a lot of that from insurance companies. And sometimes you give that up if, as you're self-funding. And what Greg is saying, have a plan in place for that. Write out everything that you've done. I've got this money here, this money there. I got this strategy for this and take care of this and fund this. And get it all out so people who are going to step in to help you and to start spending your money know what money's to spend, know what it's all about. But anyways, that's all I had. I hope this helped you understand how to start looking at all your net worth and start divvying it up. And all the little trails you can go down, all the forks in the road. Well, what if this, then that, but this? And you have to start factoring all that in to figure out how much money do you need to put aside to self-fund. But please take care of your minimum dignity floor first. A buffer and reserve, if that is important, and I personally think it is. Guaranteed inheritance, got to figure that one out. Is that important or not? Do you guys both agree if it's a case of a couple? And then the money that's left, how much should you put for self-funding and how much should go to fund spending? Here's the dichotomy between the younger and the older you. You're on that seesaw now. If we try to help the older you go up, it causes the younger you to go down. If I want the younger you to go up and enjoy more spending now, it causes the older you to go down. If there's not enough dollars to go around, or you only want to reserve enough dollars for a typical event, but protect yourself in case there's an atypical event, you might want to look closely at the leveraging strategy of some of the interest and dividends and capital gains your self-funded account will generate every year. And you can look at putting 1 percentage point, 2, 3, 4, 5 percentage points, or whatever you decide a year into a policy so you're self-funding a typical event but protecting in case there's an atypical event. It's a pretty cool strategy. Think things over as you're trying to decide what you're going to do. Chris, do you have anything else you want to say?
No, I think that filled up the show pretty well. So I want to thank everybody for listening again. And if you have any questions on this topic or others, please reach out to us. I know we're going to, I don't know that we're going to do another LTC
we're going to let this sleeping horse lie or whatever that saying okay. is. Isn't so that gonna, sleeping horse lie?
Yeah, we can go with that.
What's sleeping?
Let a sleeping dog lie.
A sleeping dog lie?
Mm-hmm.
No way. I have a dog. Well, I had a dog, but he died. But I've never, no. Sleep, Greg, is it sleeping horse or sleeping dog?
Dog.
Who signs your paychecks, Greg?
It's dog. Don't let his gymisms skew the way you know to be true in your mind. That's the danger on this show is he'll say something and it sounds kind of reasonable and then you start to self doubt. No, it's
we call that don't go
let the sleeping
the
dog lie. Yeah. Okay. Anyway,
whatever. We're gonna let this sleeping dog lay, and we're gonna put it aside. We're going to cover some other topics for the next few EDU shows to break it up, but then we're going to bring Greg back, and we're going to start talking. I want to him to start sharing, me talk less, him talk more, on how do you design one of these traditional LTC policies, Greg? What are some of the features that should be looked for out of any insurance that you can buy? Homeowners insurance, auto insurance, health insurance, life insurance, to me... Long-term care insurance is the most flexible. It's like it's made out of Play-Doh.
And most confusing.
And most confusing.
Because of that.
Because of all the flexibility. Yeah. You can add so many features to them. Correct, Greg?
That's true.
And you can't compare a policy with Company A with a policy with Company B because they're all going to have different features. They are so flexible to design. So I want Greg to come on and share some of the features that he likes, some of the features that maybe he doesn't like, and give a little insight on how you design a long-term care policy. Now, you do-it-yourselfers. I know you loathe working with agents or brokers or investment advisors. Hopefully you don't loathe working with financial planners like Chris and I, and Greg too. But I know you loathe working with anyone. I got news for you. There's no place you can go and buy LTC on your own that I know of. Are there any websites, Greg, where people can go and buy it on their own? I have no idea. I doubt it.
Well, there are websites.
Are there?
There are websites where you can get quotes,
but actually,
you're going to deal with an agent at some point.
At some point, you have to deal with an agent. LTC is sold through an agent relationship. And I don't know if there's any website that you can just go to and buy an LTC policy and think, oh, I'm getting a deal. Yeah. Doesn't matter. You're going to have to go through at some point an agent. We're going to try to give you the information so when you're chatting with the agent, you don't feel like a fool. But if you do decide to go the LTC route, you are at some point going to have to deal with a person. So whether you like it or not, you're going to have to do that. You do it yourself first. But I'm trying to give you the information. Today I was trying to give you the logical steps and the logical thinking you have to do as you're trying to divvy up your cherry pie, what we call positioning. And later we'll have Greg share some of the features you should look for in long-term care policies.
Perfect. Well, thanks, Greg, for joining us. Look forward to the next time that you're on. I'll promise I'll make Jim give you more words next time. Your word count needs to go up.
His word count needs to go up.
Yeah, yours down. It's kind of like that teeter-totter. Jim goes down.
Right.
Other words go up.
Greg goes up.
Yeah. But, we'll get... I don't know as much about the policy features as I'd like to, so I'm going to learn as much as everybody else going through those. So if anybody has an idea for a future... Yeah. Okay, awesome. If anybody has an idea for a future show, just go to our website, jimhelps.com. On there, you can submit your ideas or submit a question if you have a question for us. You can also learn a little bit more about us and what we do there on that website. Again, it's jimhelps.com. Jim, thanks for coming in the office to do the show again with us today.
No problem. I didn't mind coming in today. And Friday when we record the EDU show, I'll probably be at home. But... I will chat with everybody again on a future show. And if you want to reach out and send us a question, you again, go to our website or just email me, jim@jimhelps.com. And we will try to get your question on a future show.
Perfect. Well, thanks to everybody for listening. We'll be back next week with a brand new show.
You have listened to Jim on the radio.
read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Salmier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Salmier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. Or call 970-530-0556.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested indirectly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer member FINRA SIPC. Advisory services offered through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salmier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Jim Salmier & Associates, LLC, and Cambridge are not affiliated.